Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
Today we're plunging into a really fascinating quiet science. It sort of explains the chaos of a warming world. We're talking about phenology.
Right, phenology. It's the study of nature's seasonal timing. And we're basing this discussion on the foundational work of Dr. Teresa M. Cremins.
And phenology, it's not just some abstract nature calendar, is it?
No, not at all. It's actually this specific, very sensitive mechanism that makes climate change visible, you know, tangible, deeply local.
So, like, if you've ever noticed the lilacs blooming, say, 3 weeks early, or maybe migrating birds showing up way too soon.
Exactly. That's phenology in action. You've witnessed it.
I think that's why this is so powerful.
Yeah.
Because we hear about global temperature averages, CO2 levels, but those numbers, they feel kind of abstract, right?
We do. Very abstract. Phenology answers the question, how can you tangibly see the effects of global change right here? Like in your own local park or even your backyard?
And our mission today really is to show you how just looking closely, you know, really observing a tree or a flower can turn you into a crucial contributor.
A contributor to scientific research.
Yes. We want to help transform that casual observation into scientifically meaningful climate data.
Okay, so to guide us through this, we're looking at the work of Dr. Teresa M. Cremins. You mentioned she's perfectly positioned for this research. Tell us a bit about her.
Yeah, Dr. Cremins is, well, she's the director of the USA National Phenology Network. That's the USANPN.
USANPN, got it.
And she's also an associate research scientist at the University of Arizona. Now, that might sound like a lot of acronyms, but what it really means is that she manages the central infrastructure, the very system that makes modern, large-scale phenological study possible.
Wow. So she's not just a researcher using the data. She basically built the highway that data travels on.
Precisely. Yeah, that's a great way to put it. She manages this huge citizen science program called Nature's Notebook.
Nature's Notebook.
And her perspective is really distinctive because she bridges that gap between, you know, rigorous ecological science and the practical, widespread public engagement you need to gather data on a continental scale.
So she's really democratized the field in a way.
Absolutely. Proving that non-scientists, regular people, are essential. Not just helpful, but essential.
Okay, let's look at the central argument of her work then. The timing of natural events like when things bloom or leaves appear, migration. She describes this as a fundamental indicator.
A fundamental and sensitive indicator of planetary health. That's the core message, really.
So her book shows how we can take something abstract like climate change and see its concrete reality.
Exactly. Like when you observe a particular oak tree leafing out earlier than, say, it did for your grandparents. That's it right there. Concrete.
And the narrative journey she lays out.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds pretty compelling. It starts with just basic human observation.
Yeah, the fundamental human desire to track the seasons. She traces that knowledge way back. Ancient agriculture, indigenous environmental knowledge. It's deep-rooted.
But then there's a pivot to the crisis.
A dramatic pivot, yeah. To how climate change is distorting these critical cues. It leads to what scientists call ecological mismatches.
Mismatches. Meaning things are out of sync.
Totally out of sync. The co-evolved timing of the natural world is literally falling apart.
And the conclusion points towards, well, solutions.
Towards solutions, yeah. Relying heavily on citizen science, technology, and crucially, adaptation. We have to adapt.
And there's an urgency to this.
Oh, definitely. These phenological shifts are accelerating. They're disrupting natural rhythms that have been stable for, well, centuries.
And it's not just wildlife, right? This hits us, too.
Directly. It impacts everything from food security. Think about an early bloom getting wiped out by a late frost to public health.
You mentioned allergies earlier.
Yeah. Longer, more severe allergy seasons because of warmer springs. These are impacts we're living with right now. It's not some distant future problem.
Okay, let's dive into the specifics, the science.
Yeah.
What are the sort of nuts and bolts here, the basic unit of this research?
Right, so that unit is called a phenophase.
Phenophase.
Yeah. These are the observable, repeatable stages in an organism's life cycle. So instead of just saying spring, scientists track specific events like first open flower or new leaves emerging or even falling leaves in the autumn. These clear, quantifiable events are the basic data points they need.
And the real power comes from tracking this over long periods. We're not just comparing this year to last year.
Oh, much longer. Far from it. We're talking timescales that can span millennia, actually.
Millennia? Wow.
Yeah, the famous Kyoto Cherry Blossom Records, for instance, they offer over 1,200 years of continuous data.
1,200 years.
And that monumental data set is, well, it's hard proof that peak bloom is happening earlier now than at any other point in its recorded history. It's undeniable.
It's staggering that centuries of just careful record keeping are now vital scientific baselines. I was really fascinated by the Henry David Thoreau example.
Ah, Thoreau,
his
yeah.
journals from Walden Pond in the 1850s. I always thought of them as, you know, beautiful philosophy, nature writing.
Which they are.
But Crimmins argues his detailed notes on when plants bloomed. They've become this invaluable baseline data set for climate research in New England today.
Absolutely. They are truly, as she puts it, like messages in a bottle from a more stable past.
Messages in a bottle. I like that. Okay, so if nature's been keeping time for millennia, how does it do it? What's the clock mechanism? What are the drivers organisms use?
Good question. Organisms rely on basically two fundamental environmental cues. The first one is temperature.
Go ahead.
Specifically, the accumulation of warmth over time. Scientists measure this using something called growing degree days, or GDD.
Growing degree days. GDD. Can you break that down? Because that seems like the crucial one that's changing.
Yeah, it really is. So think of GDD as like a plant's internal odometer for warmth.
An odometer for warmth, okay.
Right. When the temperature outside rises above a certain baseline, let's say 40 degrees Fahrenheit, just as an example, each day, that warmth kind of accumulates. It adds miles to the odometer.
Uh-huh.
So when the plant or maybe an insect hits a specific mileage on that odometer, say 500 GDD, it knows, okay, time to bloom or time to emerge, regardless of the actual calendar date.
And because global temperatures are rising.
That odometer hits the critical mileage much sooner in the year. The clock is running fast.
That's a great analogy. So the temperature clock is speeding up. What's the second clock?
The second clock is photoperiod, basically day length.
Day length.
Yeah. And this is a highly stable, predictable cue. It's based purely on the Earth's orbit around the sun. Climate change can't speed up the day or shorten the night.
Okay. So one clock is speeding up, the other is stable.
And that difference is key because many plants cue heavily on GDD, the fast clock, but many animals or insects might cue more on the stable photoperiod or a different mix of cues, and that sets up the crisis.
The mismatch. If the plant is using the fast temperature clock and the insect relies on the stable day length clock, they get out of sync.
Bingo. That's the ecological mismatch, or what scientists sometimes call trophic asynchrony.
Trophic asynchrony, okay.
It just means that the complex, co-evolved timing between interacting species like plants and their pollinators or predators and their parages, it falls apart.
Yeah.
They're operating on different calendars now.
And the classic case study Dr. Crimmins uses is the great tits and winter moth caterpillars in Europe.
Yes, that one perfectly illustrates the disaster. So the caterpillars are the main food for the baby birds, right?
Right.
The caterpillars rely mostly on rising spring warmth GDD to emerge from their eggs. So they're emerging earlier and earlier each year.
Because it's warmer sooner.
Exactly. But the great tits, the birds, they time their nesting based on a combination of factors, including maybe day length, that haven't shifted as rapidly.
So the chicks hatch.
Too late. They hatch too late and miss the peak availability of the caterpillars. The main food source is already gone or declining, and the result is devastatingly low survival rates for the baby birds.
Wow. That's a really clear example of the ripple effect. And this isn't just happening out in the woods, right? It hits us too. Public health.
Yeah, back to public health. Those warmer springs mean a longer growing season for plants like ragweed. If the first frost comes later in the fall.
The pollen season lasts longer.
Lasts longer and can be more intense. So understanding these phenological shifts is critical for public health officials trying to, you know, anticipate and manage allergies for millions of people. It helps predict the season's severity.
Okay, so these disruptions are cascading, they're accelerating.
Yeah.
How are scientists even managing to study this across huge areas like continents?
It's a combination of methods, really layered. The bedrock, the foundation, is still ground observation.
Boots on the ground.
Exactly. Provided by standardized citizen science programs like Nature's Notebook, which is part of the USANPN, this gives you that high-resolution, species-specific detail you just can't get any other way.
And then you bring in the technology.
And you bring in the tech, yeah. They use near-surface remote sensing. These are automated cameras, often called phenocams.
Phenocams.
Yeah, they take regular photos from a fixed point, like looking at the same patch of forest every day to track seasonal changes automatically, like green up in spring.
And then the really big picture.
For the really big picture, we have satellite remote sensing. Satellites track global vegetation health using metrics like NDVI, that's the Normalized Difference Vegetation Index, basically how green things are from space.
But I found her key insight here really powerful. Mm. Technology hasn't replaced the human observer.
Not at all. It's actually validated their necessity. It's crucial.
Why is that?
Well, satellite data gives us amazing continental trends, right? But a sensor 500 miles up can't tell the difference between, say, a native wildflower blooming early and an invasive weed taking over a field. They might both look green.
Ah.
Only a trained human observer on the ground provides that subtle, species-specific detail. And that's what you need for actionable research and management.
That connection between individual human effort and, like, continental scale understanding.
Yeah.
That feels like a core theme.
It really is. Runs right through the book.
So let's maybe pull out some of those key messages Dr. Crimmins wants us to take away.
Okay. Well, first big one is phenology is the planet's vital sign. If you need an immediate measurable gauge of ecosystem health and how it's responding to global warming, phenology provides it.
Like an EKG for the Earth.
Exactly like an EKG for the Earth. It's an early warning system. Much more sensitive in some ways than just global temperature charts.
And then there's the theme that really resonates with us here. The accessibility of scientific contribution.
Yes, this is huge. Phenology doesn't require fancy lab equipment or, you know, advanced degrees. It just requires careful attention, your eyes, and maybe a notebook.
It democratizes science.
It really does. It validates the observation skills that everyone has, potentially.
And you also mentioned the connection to the past.
Right. The theme of ancient wisdom meets modern science. She shows how traditional ecological knowledge, indigenous seasonal calendars, generations of farmers' lore provides invaluable context and critical baseline data for our current high-tech research. It connects us across time.
And finally, the one that maybe hits closest to home.
Climate change made visible. Phenological change is local. It's undeniable when you see it. That early leaf out on the maple tree in your neighborhood, it's not just a curiosity. It is direct personal evidence of global change.
Yeah, it takes the abstract and makes it immediate. Right in front of
Precisely.
You.
Precisely.
She uses such vivid language, too.
Wow.
I remember one metaphor about the ecological mismatch.
Oh, the symphony one.
Yes. That one really stuck with me. She describes phenology as a symphony composed over millennia where every species knows its cue.
Mm.
Climate change is a reckless conductor, altering the tempo for some instruments but not others, resulting in a cacophony.
It's such a powerful image, isn't it? It perfectly captures the danger. It's not just that things are early. It's that the relative timing, the harmony, is destroyed. Cacophony.
And then there's the direct call to action, the empowerment message.
Yeah, the idea that the most powerful instrument is your own power of observation applied systematically in your own backyard. Every person can be a sensor.
Every person can be a sensor. That's a direct invitation, isn't it? Stop being just a spectator.
Become an environmental steward. Exactly. And of course, she stresses the value of history again. Those historical records, like Thoreau's journals, have become invaluable scientific baselines messages in a bottle from a more stable past.
It really underscores why we need to keep collecting this data continuously.
Absolutely essential.
Okay, so if we accept this call to action, what are the practical, real-life applications? How does this info translate into, you know, better outcomes?
Well, the most accessible application is just personal environmental awareness. Start your own phenology journal, maybe.
Yeah.
Or even better, join a program like Nature's Notebook.
Just paying closer attention.
Exactly. That mindful relationship with nature, it changes how you perceive your environment every single time you step outside. You start seeing the timing.
And we talked about public health predicting pollen seasons.
Right. But think about agriculture, too. Farmers are increasingly using those growing degree day calculations we talked about.
To build models.
To build specific phenological models, yeah. This helps them precisely optimize planting schedules and, really critically, predict when pests are likely to emerge.
Ah, so instead of just spraying pesticides based on the calendar date.
They can spray only when the pest has reached its most vulnerable life stage based on the actual accumulated warmth. It makes pest control way more targeted, more efficient, and often uses less pesticide.
That's smarter management.
Much smarter. And in conservation, land managers rely heavily on this data.
How so?
Well, for timing crucial efforts, For example, knowing the exact timing of plant growth helps them schedule prescribed burns to maybe avoid sensitive bird nesting times. Or they can manage invasive species when they're most vulnerable, like during their flowering period.
It guides practical action on the ground.
Definitely.
This whole deep dive has really reframed how I think about seasonal change. I honestly never realized that something as seemingly simple as when a flower opens could be a vital piece of international climate data. What was the biggest takeaway for you?
For me, I think it's the concept of gaining a new kind of environmental literacy. Phenology gives you this ability to read the landscape, not just for what is there, but for its critical life-dependent timing. It really does transform you from just being a passive observer into an active interpreter of change.
An active interpreter. I like that. And for me, I think it's realizing the scientific value of just historical diligence. The fact that the Marsham family in England provided over 200 years of continuous data just by writing down seasonal events in a notebook.
Incredible, isn't it?
It makes you realize that our careful observations today, they're literally gifts we're sending to future generations.
Yeah.
Data they will need.
That's absolutely right. And maybe that's the provocative thought to leave everyone with. Those subtle, beautiful timing changes you observe in your garden, in the local park, they aren't just nature running a bit early.
They're more than that.
They are the critical, verifiable data scientists need. Data to help adapt human society and ecosystems to a warming world. Your observation, it really is a vital part of the solution.
A great challenge and opportunity to take forward.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.